Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, the Pacific Crest Trail runs over 2,600 miles from Mexico to Canada. Usually a few hundred hardy souls make the trek every year. But this year, the number of people attempting the arduous journey is in the thousands. We'll find out what the wild story is behind this latest surge in mountain activity. Also on our show today, local religious leaders speak out on the issue of ISIS and Islam. And we'll learn about the Fresno County Library's new exhibit about the life of William Saroyan. All that and more coming up later this hour on Valley Edition. Right now, though, our cover story today. Fresno County continues to be plagued with high teen pregnancy and even higher STD rates. In some cases, among the worst in the state. With that in mind, local health leaders are urging One Valley School District to bring back sex ed to the classroom. As FM 89's Deanna Aguilera reports, even former students are speaking up.
18-year-old Antonio Jauregui says his freshman year at Fresno's Duncan Polytechnical High School was all about growing up. It's also when he had his first romantic relationship, and that left him turning to the classroom for information about sex.
They didn't really bring up, like, you know, STDs. They never mentioned, like, you know, condoms or barriers or birth control or anything like that.
That's because Fresno Unified School District used to offer a class called Sociology for Living, where students learned about some sexual health topics and relationships. But the district canceled it in 2011, leaving students looking for other ways to learn.
Probably the place that we got the information wasn't always the best. You know, just talking about, like, a teenage male, even that happened with someone like, you know, my friends that I know that think it's smarter to use two condoms or anything like that. They don't know the right information.
Jauregui is now a youth health counselor for Fresno Barrios Unidos, which is urging the district to restore the class. In a recent board meeting, Fresno Unified officials discussed the idea of bringing back sex education. Local public health officials applaud the conversation, yet they wonder why it took so long. Dr. Brent Fudell is a UCSF Fresno pediatric resident. During his residency, he worked with a group of girls from Fresno High School.
The vast majority of questions that these girls had were simply about pregnancy. How do I get pregnant? How do I prevent getting pregnant? You know, I'm taking the pill. Does that prevent sexually transmitted infections? Or I'm taking the Depo shot. You know, does that prevent HIV? And obviously, no, it doesn't.
And what worries health officials are the numbers. Fresno County has some of the highest rates of teen pregnancy in the state, along with the fourth highest rate of teens with chlamydia and gonorrhea infections. At the same time, rates of HIV and syphilis are increasing. And Fresno Unified students have the highest rates of chlamydia and gonorrhea of all Fresno County school districts. UCSF Fresno resident Dr. Albert Chow says sexual education is the best way to reach the most number of teenagers. He says research has shown that comprehensive sex ed can help reduce the rates of STDs.
The states that tended to support or emphasize abstinence tended to have higher rates of STDs in pregnancy, whereas states that tend to emphasize comprehensive sex ed had lower rates.
By law, schools are required to teach HIV and AIDS prevention, but it's not mandatory for them to offer sex ed classes. But that soon may change. A new bill in the legislature would make comprehensive sex education mandatory, including information on STDs and contraception. Fresno Unified's Associate Superintendent of Curriculum, Rosario Sanchez, says financers were part of the concern when the district dropped sex ed, but it was also classroom time.
At the time, they made a difficult decision, and there may have been some budget concerns, but it was also to be able to open up some other opportunities for our kids. So by not having that class, they could do more A through G requirement classes. They could do AP. They could do electives.
But Sanchez says after looking at the stark statistics, the district is planning to restore comprehensive sex ed in high school.
It truly is a community issue. we are now at this point where our board has told us, you know, they're ready to start having us look at implementation.
So far, she says the majority of the board is in favor. Trustee Brooke Ashton says he supports proper sexual education, but he questions whether things like LGBTQ issues should be taught at school. He also says in order for sex ed to work, parents must be involved and not just the school.
We feed the kids breakfast. We feed them lunch. We have marriage and family therapists on staff. We pick them up for school. We take them home. We give them before school. We're able to keep them after school. And now we're teaching them about sex ed. So what are the parents doing?
Socorro Santillan with Fresno Barrios Unidos says the district plays an important role.
And even situations where you do have close-knit families, kids are too scared to ask their parents because they're scared their parents are not going to love them no more if they're sexually active.
For Antonio Jauregui, the 18-year-old who just graduated high school, it wasn't so much that he was scared to ask his parents. He says it's simply a topic you don't discuss at home.
Just in my household, questions about like sex or birth control or relationships or anything like that, they don't really come up and they're not expected to. Like if you do have a question, you're expected to go somewhere else.
Local health leaders say that's the reality for many students in the Central Valley, and that's why it's urgent to act. Fresno Unified officials are expected to discuss restoring sex education at a board meeting in late August. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Diana Aguilera.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. When it rains in California, millions of gallons of water runs down city streets, into storm drains, and in many areas, out to the Pacific Ocean. But with the state in its fourth year of drought, it can't afford to waste it. Some cities are capturing that rain by soaking it up like a sponge. Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento on what may be urban California's next big untapped water supply.
It's a busy morning in a San Fernando Valley neighborhood. On Elmer Avenue, people are hopping in their cars and garbage trucks are making their rounds. Looking to the northeast, you can see mountains.
Those mountains is where it all starts.
Eileen Alduenda is with the Council for Watershed Health.
Those are the San Gabriel Mountains. The historic watershed had water moving through those mountains and straight down Elmer Avenue into the Paseo.
The Paseo is an alley at the end of the street. She and ecologist Chris Solik know a lot about how water moves through this valley when it rains.
The watershed is still there, but what's changed is the surface has become almost completely impervious.
Decades ago, homes were built, roads were paved, and now 40 acres of concrete funnel water down this one block of Elmer Avenue. So when it rains, the street becomes a stream and it floods.
So all the water is coming down on a hard surface because it has nowhere to go. In a natural system, it has a chance to slow down, spread out, and sink in.
It becomes groundwater, which the city and the rest of the state desperately need in a drought. But urban areas in California have spent decades engineering a landscape to send water away as quickly as possible. 5 years ago, Elmer Avenue became LA's first residential test site to instead treat water as a scarce resource that should be captured.
So this is where it all starts at Elmer Avenue.
Chris Solik takes me to what he calls the upstream end of the avenue and points to what looks like a typical storm drain in the sidewalk. But what's underneath makes all the difference.
Typically, catch basins are concrete, so the water hitting that concrete just runs off directly into the storm drain system and it goes to the ocean. In this case, a soft bottom allows water to percolate, to infiltrate the soil, and augment that groundwater.
Colorful, drought-tolerant plants line the sidewalks. And it isn't just pretty landscaping. These are bioswells, ditches engineered to slow down water so it soaks into the ground to mimic a natural landscape. Under Elmer Avenue, there's more, an engineered system that allows water to filter through layers of soil.
So when they created the Elmer Avenue project, they had to excavate, open up the street, and actually put these things into the ground and then repave the streets.
Permeable driveways also help sponge up water. Chris Solik says in 2 years, the street was able to capture enough water to supply up to 66 households daily. That's 32 acre feet. The Elmer Avenue pilot project helped spark a similar project just a few miles away.
So this is our traditional Green Street project.
Art Castro is a civil engineer with the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. He's on the Woodman Avenue median, a bioswale that's collecting rainwater from the surrounding 120 acres.
The whole thing is 3,500 feet long, 3/4 mile, and this captures roughly 55 acre feet a year.
Castro is a big proponent of stormwater capture, but he says the highest hurdle is cost. The Elmer Avenue project cost $2.5 million. Woodman cost three. Castro says LADWP needs to capture much more stormwater, either to survive a drought or deal with a future of more intense storms. There's a nearly $30 million project in the works.
We're going to have 16,000 acre feet per year. That's roughly 80,000 homes per year that we could potentially supply with.
$200 million is available in last year's water bond to get small and large projects like these off the ground. A Pacific Institute study found that capturing stormwater in San Francisco and Southern California alone could provide up to 600,000 acre feet of water a year, enough to supply 1.2 million households. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
This is Valley Edition. The alleged murder of a San Francisco woman by an undocumented immigrant with a criminal history has revived a debate in the state capital over sanctuary cities. Katie Orr reports from Sacramento.
San Francisco is one of several California sanctuary cities, which generally have a policy of not informing federal authorities about undocumented immigrants in their areas. The suspect had been in San Francisco custody in April, but was released. Republican State Senator Jeff Stone says sanctuary cities are usurping federal law. He's proposing a bill that would tighten restrictions on local law enforcement.
Any local police department or county sheriff detain a illegal immigrant that has a felonious background and give 48 hours notice to ICE or any other federal agency that this potentially dangerous person is going to be released.
Democratic Assemblyman David Chu represents the area where the crime occurred. He says Stone's bill is redundant.
I think it's important to note that both the state and local laws say that if you've committed violent felonies, regardless of your immigration status, the law will be fully enforced.
U.S. Senator Barbara Boxer sent a letter to Governor Jerry Brown asking whether state law was followed in this case, and if so, whether it needs to be strengthened. Brown spokesman Evan Westrup said, quote, "Under the facts as reported, California law vests authority for cases of this kind within the sound discretion of local authority." At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Medi-Cal recipients in California continue to face big challenges when it comes to actually accessing care, especially in the Central Valley. That's the conclusion of a new report by researchers at the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research. The study looked at survey data from across the state for both Medi-Cal enrollees and those with private insurance provided through their employers. The study found that Medi-Cal enrollees were twice as likely to not have a usual source of care other than the emergency room and were three times as likely to have trouble finding a doctor. Last week, I spoke with one of the study's authors, UCLA Professor Shana Alex Charles. And in the interest of disclosure, the California Healthcare Foundation, which helped fund the study, is also a supporter of Valley Public Radio. Here's our conversation with Professor Charles. Your survey is looking at the difference between Medi-Cal and employer-sponsored coverage and access to care. Exactly what are the big takeaways from your research?
Well, the conclusion is that Medi-Cal is not keeping up with private job-based coverage in giving good access to care, both on the outcome side and the status side, but also really on the, you know, the actual realized side of access and potential access for its enrollees. So there's still some work for Medi-Cal to do in terms of being able to be equivalent in coverage to the private industry.
What do we see in different parts of the state as far as that goes?
Well, you know, comparing different parts of the state with each other, we found some good data, but not necessarily surprising data, which means that, you know, current trends that we've seen continuing where, you know, the parts of the state that are wealthier parts of the state, the Bay Area region, you know, ends up being the best access to care. And then the not as wealthy parts of the state, which would include, you know, Fresno area, the Central Valley, end up having kind of worse access to care, even within the Medi-Cal population.
Your study shows that Medi-Cal enrollees are twice as likely to not have a usual source of care other than the emergency room, three times as likely to have trouble finding a doctor. So can you talk about that, what that means?
Sure. And these two words, potential and realized access, are very important, and that's why we wanted to look at it. The fact is health insurance doesn't mean anything unless it gets you good health care. That's the point of health insurance. And so the point of giving free public Medi-Cal to people who can't afford private health insurance or don't have jobs that offer it is to try and give them the same kind of health care that everybody else gets. And so Medi-Cal is not reaching that potential at this point. With the potential access to care, we talk about when they need care that they know they can get it. Medi-Cal has problems there, as you mentioned, with people saying their usual source of care is the emergency room. What that shows us is that they don't have a regular doctor that they know they can go to, that they just have to rely on the most expensive, costly in terms of time and effort and difficult area like the emergency room. And then the second area, which is the realized access, would be whether or not they can go see a doctor or find a doctor. And people on Medi-Cal having issues with that means that they are not able to have good continuity of care over time, a provider who knows their history over time and is able to look at them more holistically. You know, the emergency rooms are great for specific situations, but they're not good at being able to take care of people over time in a continuum of care.
Is this a problem that is unique in any way, or the data that we're seeing unique to California, or is this across the board in other states that have Medicaid programs?
Well, in terms of data, this is the only data that we have for this report is California. So we didn't look at any other states. But I will say that when you did look at Medicaid overall, another report that was done with a sister agency of ours did look at Medicaid nationally, comparing access to care for job-based coverage on a more national level, and they actually found fewer differences than we did. So there are other states that are doing a better job of this than California currently is, and I think that we really do need to take a look at our existing provider networks and being able to give people the health care that the Medi-Cal program is supposed to be providing.
You mentioned that in some ways the results aren't necessarily all that surprising given the poorer parts of the state or where we see a majority of these problems or see the problem in its most severe. Was there anything surprising in your analysis?
Well, I think what we were surprised at a little bit was the difference between children and adults. And in this case, it was a pleasant surprise in that children seemed to have better access to care and that the Medi-Cal coverage access looked more similar to the job-based coverage access than it did for adults. So, and it might be a factor of that there are certainly, you know, more children in the Medi-Cal program. It's a very large focus of the program. And, you know, in this state, we have done even a better job of getting children enrolled where they have a higher percentage of having insurance in the first place. So it's good that for kids the system is doing better than it is for adults, but I think it does show where the focus can be in the future in trying to improve access to care for adults.
Now, as I understand it, you're using data from 2012 and 2013. Would you expect to see anything different in the next data set, given the Medi-Cal expansion and other efforts along those lines?
Well, what we're expecting to see is an even more exaggeration of the patterns that we've already seen. This is an expectation. The hope would be that we would see a reduction in those patterns, that we would see increasing access to care for the Medi-Cal population as more and more people got into the program and as the program expanded in 2014. But honestly, you know, from the anecdotal evidence so far and, you know, from the issues of people who are newly enrolled in a program trying to maneuver within the health system that they haven't had before, we're probably going to see even more use of the ER as a usual source of care as people, you know, try to navigate and find their own doctors and worse problems. But hopefully that will not be the case.
You talk about the effort to close the access gap between a Medi-Cal and employer-sponsored coverage. I know your study doesn't get so much into the solutions side, but is it as simple as simply increasing provider premiums and state support for providers, or is it more complicated than that in some way?
Well, even increasing premium support is very complicated. You know, the state has had a history of trying to reduce provider payments over the last decade or so. And in fact, the courts had to step in and stop those reductions because that's historically been a way that California has looked to try and balance its budget, is to cut payments to Medi-Cal providers. So even if we could get that, it would be very difficult just to get that. But the problem is, honestly, is that as a system, health insurance in this state has undergone transformations that have kind of highlighted where the fracture points are. And I think providers are feeling like they're being asked to do more with less, and they were already working at below cost to begin with, which is leading to all of these big consolidations, is so many providers don't want to try and go it alone, and even big companies are feeling that they want to merge to cover their own bases and to integrate. So the problem here is that, as you say, there are no simple solutions. If we were able to graduate 10,000 more doctors who all suddenly agreed to take Medi-Cal patients, I still think the problem wouldn't necessarily be solved overnight. So it's something that will remain to be fixed and seen as the years go on. But I do think great steps have been made. I know in Los Angeles County, on the local level, the strong focus has been on trying to attach a provider to a new enrollee as soon as they enroll. So not just giving someone a card and saying, okay, now you go out and find a provider, but at the point of enrollment, identifying, okay, here is the hospital you're going to be affiliated with, here's the doctor's office, you can choose this doctor or not, and starting that from the enrollment process side. And I think if we link that statewide, where we can get access to care and that second step be a part of the actual enrollment process, I think that would really go a long way to helping people being able to use the healthcare system effectively.
We've been talking with UCLA health policy professor Shayna Alex Charles about a new study from the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research about the differences between Medi-Cal and private employer-based health insurance when it comes to actually accessing a doctor or a hospital. Professor Charles, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great, thank you.
And stay with us on Valley Edition coming up in the next half of our program, a talk with Fresno religious leaders about ISIS and Islam. We'll get a multi-faith perspective on the issues following a forum in Fresno a few days ago. That and what's behind the big boost in interest in hiking the Pacific Crest Trail all the way from Mexico to Canada. We'll go to Yosemite and find out why more and more hikers are wild about such an arduous journey. That's all coming up on Valley Edition, straight ahead.
What's important to you? Local news reporting?
With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
And even though the riverbed is barren and wells are dry in East Porterville, it's quite possible that Johnson is really the river, the rain, and the health this town needed. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
Valley Public Radio is building a new home, and your support is needed.
Construction is underway on our state-of-the-art 10,000-square-foot broadcast center, but we need your help.
Your major gift can help us cross the finish line and move in next year.
Naming opportunities are now available for Valley Public Radio's new 10,000-square-foot facility at the Research and Technology Park in Clovis.
Your major gift offers significant tax advantages.
Help us build the future of public radio. Call 800-275-0764 to learn more.
listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. The Pacific Crest Trail runs 2,650 miles from Mexico to Canada. Usually a few hundred hardy souls make the trek every year, but this year about 10 times that number are attempting the arduous journey. Leslie McClurg hiked a section of the trail to find out what's driving its popularity.
The Tuolumne Meadows Post Office in Yosemite National Park is packed. Ragged hikers wait in a long, twisting line outside.
Hey, guys, can you just bend the line this way, actually?
It's 6 p.m. The post office was supposed to close at 4, but Postmaster Michael Kojacki says he's staying open late to clear out the piles of resupply boxes that have been sent ahead by family and friends. This is his 18th summer in Yosemite.
This year, it's particularly busy because some people are saying the book Wild and the movie Wild, and last year Wild was a big deal because Oprah put her stamp on the book, is what we were told.
It's called The Wild Effect. Cheryl Strayed's best-selling memoir was published in 2012, and the film starring Reese Witherspoon came out last December. Before Wild, about 300 permits were issued annually. The Pacific Crest Trail Association estimates this year's tally will be more like 3,000. The nonprofit promotes and protects the trail. Witherspoon's face is front and center on their website, and one click brings you to a video starring Cheryl Strayed. Her story begins in the scorching Mojave Desert.
Oh my God. What have I done?
A group of hikers in Yosemite were tormented by the same question as they trudged north from the Mexican border.
The sun comes out and you just hide or you're going to die.
It's the worst place on earth.
There's no water anywhere. No water.
The desert will murder you. It wants to. It wants all your moisture for itself.
But none of them regret the nearly 1,000 miles they've walked so far. The drought is making the trek easier than usual. High mountain passes are free of snow, which means fewer mosquitoes than normal. Rachel D'Antona stops for a drink of water on the trail. She's a bartender in Franklin, Tennessee.
I cannot believe I'm here. It's unbelievable.
She's walked 20 to 30 miles a day. It's taught her a lot about herself.
I was definitely a stubborn human being in the real world, and I think you got to let that go out here. You just got to go with the flow and have a good time.
Ryan Bovenet is from Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. When he started hiking, he said he was burnt out after working as a chef in a fast-paced restaurant. During the 2 months he spent on the trail, he's lost 40 pounds, and he says his mind is clearer.
I mean, it's really focused my brain and kind of focused my thoughts, which are normally kind of incoherent and disconnected, and just kind of following this path every day, this straightforward, just keep going forward. You're headed towards Canada.
He says the trail has challenged him on every level.
Some days it's just hard, and you want to leave, and you want to go home, and you want TV, and you want your phone, you want service.
But Bovenet is becoming more comfortable without his gadgets. Back inside the tiny post office, packages are tightly stacked from floor to ceiling. Boxes spill out into the adjoining cafe. Hiker Max Bennett is praying new shoes sent by his girlfriend arrive soon. Duct tape holds his weathered boots together.
What's up, Bennett? You looking for your package?
Yeah, did I make it
she
in?
She hasn't made it up here yet.
Okay,
she'll
cool.
Be up here hopefully soon.
He retreats disappointed. He and his buddy Cale Rogers pass the time digging through a box of free stuff to find dinner.
Need a Ziploc?
Anyone who wants to offload extra weight can leave food or gear in a crate outside the post office.
Oatmeal.
Yeah, we found a mountain house and freeze-dried mozzarella cheese.
Bennett checks for his package one final time.
Oh, man. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Of course.
He hugs the box to his chest. Every hiker at the post office said they would be both counting down the miles ahead to the Canadian border and at the same time savoring each step. I'm Leslie McClurg.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. A few days ago, members of clergy, law enforcement, and other communities gathered in Fresno for a roundtable discussion titled ISIS versus Islam. Does ISIS follow or ignore the principles of Islam? Here to bring a little taste of that forum to our audience today, we have two guests joining us in our studio. We have from the First Congregational Church of Christ, United Church of Christ, Reverend Norman Broadbent, and also the Imam of the Islamic Cultural Center of Fresno, Sayed Ali Ghazvini. Thank you both for joining us and taking time from your busy schedules to join us today. And Imam, thank you so much during Ramadan for joining us.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you, yes.
Why did you feel the need to have this event in Fresno last week?
Well, we do believe that ISIS is creating a serious threat against the globe, including United States. So we wanted to educate ourselves and others about the threats that ISIS might create, and how to really respond to that. And let people know that ISIS is not part of our faith. Actually, it is violating principles of our faith. And also let youth know that ISIS is an evil organization. Nobody should join ISIS.
And my participation was to be one of the representatives of three religious traditions, although I have to be clear in saying that I represent a particular North American Protestant tradition. And one of the clarifications that was important for me to make as a part of our extraordinary panel that night is that we here have to make some distinctions between a North American Christianity and the Christianity that exists in the Middle East, which is a very, very different character, where for generations, Christians and Muslims have lived together collaboratively, cooperatively, and it's a very different kind of a picture than we normally get through our more traditional and accessible filters here in North America.
And turning back to you, Sayed, when you see the violence that we see in the Middle East right now that is tied to ISIS, you see that across the globe, but you're also concerned about that here at home. Why the concern there, and how much of a concern is it to get your to communicate your message to local communities? Because as we saw after September 11th, there was a lot of misunderstanding in communities over Islam. Is that a concern that you have right now in terms of the general population's understanding of what your faith is versus ISIS?
Yes, actually we have two concerns. One concern is that how our community and how our faith is represented in the public opinion, how people perceive our community and faith, and we want to make very clear that our community and faith denounce ISIS and denounce its terrorist tactics and also acts. And also, we want to raise this concern that ISIS it might hit anywhere in the globe, including here at home. They are like an Ebola disease. You never know where they are going to hit, and you never know until it appears physically. It appears. It takes a lot of resources to fight them.
Certainly, there are all sorts of very violent regimes across the globe that know no boundaries of religion and faith. When you see what has happened with ISIS, in your opinion, looking at it from your perspective, what do you see as the prime driver there? You mentioned those who are at risk and those who might want to follow that path as being contrary to your religion, yet they have adopted that nomenclature, that name. In your opinion, where are the seeds of what is happening right now?
Well, they recruited through a very powerful tool, which is the social media. They have an aggressive policy toward marketing toward the youth everywhere, not only Muslims. Now they all also reach to non-Muslims. And this is what our concern is, that to give awareness to people that ISIS is a very evil organization. It doesn't matter how they look on social media or on YouTube. the way they present themselves, that they are helping children or women or poor people. This is an evil organization, and we want everyone to know that this is an evil organization. So we do have a concern in the way they approach different people. And before, we used to think that they target people in poor neighborhoods with a poor economy. Now we can see people in good-doing social class. A lot of them are joining them. Before, we used to think that only the jobless would join them. Now, in fact, even people who have good jobs, good university education, they are also might fall as victims to ISIS.
That's the voice of Sayed Ali Ghazvani, the spiritual leader of the Islamic Cultural Center of Fresno. We're also joined today by Reverend Dr. Norman Broadbent of the First Congregational Church of Fresno, United Church of Christ, talking about a recent forum that the Islamic Cultural Center held, a multi-faith, a multi-background forum, including education leaders, local law enforcement, national law enforcement, and others, about ISIS versus Islam. Turning now to Reverend Broadbent, what do you see the role of the interfaith community playing here in trying to deal with something like this? Because as the imam was just telling us, it may be far away on the news, yet there is certainly concern about what might happen here.
That's correct. And I think one of the important points that came out in the course of our actually wasn't so much of a round table as it was a very long table with law enforcement and educators present. One of our panel members had made the very clear point that what we are really dealing with in the defining of ISIS is not something that we have traditionally dealt with in the past as sort of a national movement or something that's defined by national boundaries. It's an ideology. And I know that somebody who has worked in the counterterrorism programs for the United States had said that it's really clear that you do not necessarily defeat something like ISIS simply with guns, that it's an ideology, and it is an ideology that has to be confronted. And that does have ramifications for religious community. I think that we were joined by Rabbi Rick Weiner on that same panel, who made, I think, the very telling and important point that any time you see this conflation of violence with espoused political ends, be very, very wary. And that is not a theology, that is an ideology, and that it is incumbent upon all of our major religious traditions, which espouse common shared values of peace and reconciliation, justice, forgiveness, and also confession, that those are some of our tools to work with within our various collaborative efforts. Here in Fresno, for example, we have beyond Fresno, just the Central Valley, we have the Interfaith Alliance of Central California that is a collaborative of Muslims, Christians, Jews, Sikhs, Hindus, Buddhists, Native American religious traditions, Unitarian Universalist, New Thought churches. And we meet on a regular basis, a monthly basis, coming together to discuss ways of deepening our mutual understanding and developing cooperation. And so in part, what our task would be as individual communities is to not deny our own faith traditions, but to speak from the heart of those parts of our faith traditions that do broaden an understanding of the other, of one another. And that becomes a way by which we confront the ideology that becomes so much of the seedbed for a group like ISIS.
Now, I want to ask about some of the local steps and local connections with law enforcement in a moment, as I know that Chief Jerry Dyer, Fresno County DA Elizabeth Smitkamp, and others from the FBI were involved in your panel and can give or gave the people there some information about the local angle. But turning back to, Imam Sayed Ali Ghazvani, who's with us today from the Islamic Cultural Center of Fresno, on the global scale, what can your fellow religious leaders, fellow leaders in Islam and states across the globe, and specifically in the Middle East, what do you feel is being done and should be done to bring this message, which you're bringing to Fresno, across the board? Is there something that religious leaders can do across the board on trying to divest the connection, the false connection between ISIS and Islam?
Well, I would like to echo what Reverend Rodman said. To fight ISIS, we need education, not only guns and military aspect. We need to educate. Obviously, the world is not doing enough, because ISIS now is expanding in a very high rate, and this shows that we are not doing enough to stop ISIS from expanding. So we need awareness campaign and education on social media, on schools, colleges, and also on global media. Unfortunately, we have not done this so far. Muslims denounced terrorism on many occasions. Almost on every occasion, they denounced terrorism. But we need to start a new campaign of education in Muslim countries and outside Muslim countries to know, to teach people the spirit of Islam, the religion of peace, and peace-loving people who live among Muslims, and fight this idea of extremism. Unfortunately, there are still mosques who promote the idea of extremism in variety of places. They might not promote violent extremism, but extremism by itself is a dangerous thing to do. So we do need to approach this in an educational, ideological manner, so we can defeat the ideas and the ideology of extremism.
And Reverend Bronben, throughout history, we have seen a number of faiths, a number of movements co-opted in some way by some sort of violence or other extremism. This is not unique to Islam, is it not?
No, and that's an important point to make, that it is not necessarily a matter of connecting dots between extremism that we see coming out of religious communities in this country with ISIS. However, it is significant to note that there are numerous hate organizations in North America that have a very clear Christian identity. And as important as it is for the imam to speak to making some distinctions, that there is a real spectrum of theological interpretation of the faith, so there is within the Christian faith as well. And it's particularly incumbent upon us to be able to make those distinctions here, so that's part of our confession, that our sometimes faith does get radicalized, but when it gets radicalized, it moves away from the core of what we would hold to be the central values of that faith.
So I want to turn now to the local angle here. You did have law enforcement participate in this panel discussion that took place July 1st. What is your message to law enforcement, what is law enforcement's message to the faith community in dealing with this issue, and how concerned are both parties?
You know, I'm not a security I'm not an expert on military and security issues at all, but I do have a concern now. a concern that we see people being recruited throughout the social media, and then out of nowhere you see a violent act. Could be here in United States, could be in Europe, it could be anywhere. So I really do not know. I do not know what to suggest to the law enforcement agencies. They should know better, but I want to tell them that we do have a concern about this. Our other concern is for our fellow citizens not to confuse Muslim community and Muslim individuals who are working hard for their families, for their country, United States, here, and contributing to the well-being of their country and their home as nurses, as physicians, as home builders, as professors, as business leaders, in variety of ways they are contributing to their communities and to their country, not to confuse them with those extremist.
And what I heard law enforcement say as a part of our conversation were several things. Just to reiterate what has already been said about the importance of education, providing more and more education, but using also some of the technologies at our disposal, social media that has been mentioned so commonly, that where people may be coming across messages that they have some concern for, law enforcement recommends that they be notified of that. Let them check that out. Let them check those sources to see whether or not those are legitimate concerns that have been raised. Law enforcement, I know, is very vigilant here in the Valley, because I know that both the Islamic Cultural Center and Temple Beth Israel have close relationships with local law enforcement, and unfortunately have had to respond on several different occasions to some incidents that have occurred here locally. And I know that both the chief of police and Sheriff Mims have indicated their openness and their willingness and their availability to be in connection and in constant communication with our various communities.
Again, if you just joined us today, our guests on this segment of Valley Edition have been Reverend Dr. Norman Broadbent, the First Congregational Church of Fresno, United Church of Christ, and also the Imam of the Islamic Cultural Center of Fresno, Sayed Ali Ghazvini, joining us today to talk about a forum that was recently held in Fresno, bringing together local law enforcement, education, and spiritual leaders. The forum was titled ISIS versus Islam. Does ISIS follow or ignore the principles of Islam? Thank you both for joining us today. And Imam Ghazvini, best wishes to you and your community on this Ramadan.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The Fresno County Public Library will honor a great native son this Saturday when it formally opens the new William Saroyan Gallery at the Downtown Central Library. The gallery will feature manuscripts, drawings, books, and other memorabilia documenting Saroyan's long career as a world-renowned author. Joining us now to tell us more about the gallery and the event that celebrates its opening is Lisa Lindsay. She's the library coordinator who has helped make this project possible, along with a number of other community leaders and Saroyan fans. Lisa, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thank you.
Tell us about how this project came about and how the library got involved.
All right. Well, the Central Library downtown has a San Joaquin Valley Heritage and Genealogy Center, and inside of that center, we house a William Saroyan collection that is one of the major institutional collections of materials documenting Saroyan's career. So the William Saroyan Society here in town has helped the library obtain many, many different items, and there's so many things that are really, really special to have, and it just became natural to create a space where some of that could be displayed for the public to see. And people can, of course, schedule a time to visit the library to see anything. We have unpublished works and things like that. But it's natural for just the average person to just want to, like, chance upon something like this and be excited about what Fresno has to offer.
So give us a visual of what this new center is going to look like for our radio listeners out there who can't see it or maybe thinking about going to the event.
Sure. So the library's kind of redone a section of the library. So there's display cases, there's art hanging on the wall, and then there's just really nice seating, like a place where people would want to spend time as well. And so that entire section of the library is called the William Saroyan Gallery, and individuals can local individuals that have collections or art can also in the future display to have their own art displayed in this area as well.
So when it comes to Saroyan artifacts, memorabilia, those sorts of things, in addition to the manuscripts, what does this gallery consist of?
Well, some of the highlights are we have William Saroyan's dog tags from when he served in World War II. Those are on display. We also have Saroyan's key to the city of Anjar, which he received on a trip in 1972. And then there's a lot of his original artwork. He did a lot of art. And we also have a portrait of Saroyan done by Don Freeman, and that's a children's author that William Saroyan actually helped inspire to become a children's author in the first place.
A lot of people in Fresno remember the old Saroyan exhibit at the Fresno Metropolitan Museum, which unfortunately closed a few years ago. Does this in some way fill that void of having a place that people can go and celebrate one of the Valley's most accomplished and cherished local sons?
You are right on there. Like this, the goal really is to meet that need where Fresno really does have something to celebrate here, and we're happy to have that kick off on Saturday.
So tell us about the event. You mentioned Saturday. This is when the celebration of
the gallery. We will have the official ribbon cutting event this Saturday at Central Library at 2:30, and we'll have, of course, Armenian music and food and just a really lively atmosphere. But we'll also be having the local author Armin Bacon speaking, and her most recent book is entitled My Name is Armin, and that is, of course, a spin off of one of Saroyan's books. And then rumor has it she is going to be interrupted by Mr. William Saroyan himself. So that will be very fun to watch.
We may have an appearance there. We'll be
that's
looking,
right, looking on his bike and everything.
Looking forward to that. You mentioned you worked with the William Saroyan Society. Tell us more about that and how that relationship helped to create this gallery.
Sure. They provided many of the pieces that are in the library's collection. They helped make much of that possible. And the William Saroyan Society's mission is in promoting the lifetimes and literary works of William Saroyan while educating the public about the human values depicting his writing. So this was a natural partnership to work with them for this kickoff event. And the William Saroyan Gallery was actually funded by the Friends of the Library. So they made that possible by, you know, just local citizens here in Fresno taking, you know, being excited about their library and taking part.
Yeah, yes, indeed. And I imagine there's also a number of his works in the library available for patrons to check out, correct?
You've got it. We have students come in every year that want to do their required reading for school that get turned on to his works.
And how
exciting time for Fresno.
And how important is it for an author like Saroyan when, in his case, if you go to even Amazon, a lot of his books aren't in print, kind of hard to find. I imagine that the library's collection has to be more comprehensive than you would find almost anywhere.
I think you're exactly right. And many of those works are actually signed by William Saroyan because he actually, you know, was a library patron. He would visit the Central Library and the Gillis Library up to the end of his life. So each time the library would obtain something new that was unique, they would have him come by and sign it. So there's definitely things that you can't see anywhere else in the world.
Well, William Saroyan's legacy certainly lives on with this new gallery at the Fresno County Central Library. Lisa Lindsay with the library joins us today. The event that celebrates the gallery's opening is Saturday at 2:30 at the downtown library.
On the main floor, that's right.
All right, we're looking forward to it. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, or tweet us at @KVPR and @Valley Edition for the Twitter files out there. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram, Valley Public Radio. Check us out online at kvpr.org, where you can find our podcasts and more. For our entire staff, Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. We'll have you again next week for another Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.